Unfortunately, it's been a failure, and the majority of us are sort of stuck on the sidelines holding our hands up in the air.
Senate Democrats reject the second candidate for Senate seat B. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 10th of April. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, MATSU officials are upset over legislative capital budget cuts, but the governor is not.
I appreciate their efforts there. I've offered to sit down with them and take out even more projects.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Association of Alaska School Boards, working with school districts statewide to bring innovation to classrooms through digital learning for the 21st century. Information at aasb.org.
Senate Democrats today said they have rejected Joan Nelson, Governor Palin's second choice to replace Kim Elton, who left his Senate seat to work for the Obama administration. Majority Leader Johnny Ellis said the decision came in a closed session, as all personal matters should be handled, and each member had their own reasons, pro or con, on the selection. He said he could only speak for himself.
It wasn't any one serious thing. You know, the governor asked us to set up appointments with Mr. Nelson, with the members of the caucus. That was happening on Wednesday and Thursday. And because he was basically unknown to most of us and is still unknown to us as a political quantity. He's an unknown quantity in terms of politics. But he seems like a very nice guy and well-educated. Seems like a fine young man.
Governor Palin yesterday issued a press release saying the Democrats should make haste in deciding on Nelson and urged them not to drag their feet on the choice. Ellis says there wasn't any delay. In fact, he said the governor's staff was still making appointments for Nelson to meet with individual senators, and they felt it only fair to let that process continue since the candidate was not well known.
We received the official communication from the governor on Tuesday. Wednesday and Thursday, the governor's office was arranging his appointments with Senate Democrats individually. And then on Thursday, we got together. So we have been very respectful of the process and of the community of Juneau and their need for representation. And we're comfortable with the schedule that we've been on. We've tried to play a very professional and positive role in all of this.
Governor Palin says she is disappointed that the Democrats turned down the appointment. She says Nelson was a good candidate, an experienced, educated, dynamic Native leader. Asked if she will meet with Juneau Democrats before making her next choice, she said she's already met with them.
They did not provide a list of names for us to choose from, just one name. So we went out and solicited the interested persons to the seat, did our interviews, did our vetting. And that took 20-some days to do that. When we found the candidate that we believed would best serve this area, in Mr. Grusendorf forwarded that name, and they said no. Then in speaking with those Democrat leaders, we explained to them that we had another person in mind, forwarded Joe Nelson's name, and we are where we are today.
As for the list of four candidates for the position that were submitted by the Juneau Democrats, the governor said she wasn't convinced they really wanted the job. She also said that no one is off the list, including House Minority Leader Beth Kurtula. But first, she will go through another round of interviews and decisions.
If their heels are really dug in and they say it can only be that one person, then that makes this process a little bit more difficult.
The governor has 10 days to make another appointment. An Alaska native, 39-year-old Joe Nelson, is admissions director at the University of Alaska Southeast and a member of the Sea Alaska Corporation Board of Directors. Nelson says he thought he'd be a compromise candidate. He says it's unfortunate. Juneau is stuck without Senate representation.
Throughout the whole process, it clearly hasn't been about me. It's really been all about the Juneau Democratic Party leadership and our chief state executive. And unfortunately, it's been a failure, and the majority of us are sort of stuck on the sidelines holding our hands up in the air.
Neither Nelson nor Palin's first choice, legislative employee Tim Grusendorf, were on the list of four nominees recommended by local party members. All of them have been elected by Juneau voters to a major- to a major city or statewide office. Democratic District Chairwoman Kim Metcalf says they are on the list because they have a track record. She says she hopes party leaders can meet with the governor to break the stalemate.
We've got to do something to reach a compromise, perhaps. We need to get someone seated. Juneau doesn't have representation at this time, and that is putting us at a terrible disadvantage.
If the governor takes the full 10 days to make the next appointment, Juneau will have been without Senate representation for more than half of the legislative session. Matanuska Susitna borough officials are reacting with shock over severe cuts in the Senate's version of the state budget made public yesterday. Borough manager John Duffy says the budget only contains one Matsu project.
But there's many other communities throughout the state that are in the same boat.
The state's 70% match for the borough's millions of dollars in road bonds approved by Valley voters last October fell to the budget axe, and Duffy says state support for a Port McKenzie railroad project has vanished.
We have been working on this effort for a couple of years. This is a statewide project. The major beneficiary of this rail extension is Interior Alaska, because that's where the majority of the jobs would go. This is a project that will begin to replace the revenues that the state gets from the North Slope.
Funding for the borough's prison project was also diminished. The Goose Creek Correctional Center is expected to add $100 million in payroll to the state's economy, but the Senate's first draft budget slashed state funds for the prison.
The prison project, we have started construction. There were funds in there to continue on with funding the utilities, and that has been reduced, I believe, down to $6 million.
The borough had requested $20 million for prison utilities. Duffy says he's disappointed, but that the borough will continue to work with its state delegation and with the governor to try to turn things around. That may not be likely. Governor Palin says she applauds the Senate's spending plan.
I'm saying, right on, good. This is what we want to see also. Sounds like we're working together on scaling down that scope and size of a budget. I appreciate their efforts there. I've offered to sit down with them and take out even more projects.
Palin says she spoke with Senate and House leaders on the budget yesterday. The capital projects budget is scheduled to be on the Senate floor tomorrow. Wayne Anthony Ross, Governor Palin's pick to be Attorney General, went before another legislative committee today in preparation for a vote on his confirmation to the job. He faced new complaints about his past activities and statements that many legislators found objectionable. However, Governor Palin said she is sticking by her choice.
I don't agree with probably many things that he has done or said over all these years in his 35 years of practicing law. He probably doesn't agree with a lot of things that I have done in my professional life either over all these years. We're never going to find anybody whom we 100% agree with.
She said she doesn't know if the most recent complaints about Ross are true, although she says the administration did check his record.
And I'm very comfortable with Wayne Anthony Ross serving the state of Alaska as Attorney General. That's why I brought his name forward.
The House Judiciary Committee will hold a public hearing on Ross's nomination this evening, and the Senate Judiciary Committee will hold another hearing on his nomination on Monday. The entire legislature is scheduled to vote on all the governor's nominations on Thursday. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, big ideas for waste energy generation.
Every village in Alaska can be self-sufficient in 10 years. If they so desire.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If heating your home costs more than you can manage and you have a low income, the state of Alaska has heating assistance programs that may help. The programs have expanded to include families with a higher household income. For information or an application form, call 1-800-470-3058 or visit heatinghelp.alaska.gov. Sometimes a little help makes all the difference. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Now that the charges against Ted Stevens have been dismissed, the former senator may soon be able to practice law again in the District of Columbia. His license was suspended last fall in both D.C. and California after he was convicted of lying on financial disclosure forms about gifts. But this week, Judge Emmett Sullivan threw out the guilty verdict and tossed the indictment because of prosecutorial misconduct. That means Stevens will likely soon have his law license reinstated. The District of Columbia Court of Appeals clerk says as soon as the local bar association or Stevens' lawyer contacts the court, the process will start to reinstate his license. That's likely to happen within a week. The Alaska Bar Association has also dropped its attempt to have Stevens' license suspended in Alaska. Stevens was fighting the suspension on the grounds that he planned to appeal his case, and the license was on inactive status anyway. Both sides were arguing their positions in motions to the Alaska Supreme Court. But after Stevens' conviction was thrown out this week, the Alaska Bar Association's counsel, Stephen Van Gore, withdrew their suspension request.
The court had not acted on the request for interim suspension. And in light of Judge Sullivan's order, it was appropriate for us to withdraw our motion because the basis of the motion disappeared.
Stevens has not said whether he plans to practice law in either Alaska or Washington. The 85-year-old faces paying for legal fees from his trial, estimated to be in the $2 million range. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar heads for Alaska this weekend. He's due in Dillingham on Monday for a town meeting to see how people feel about an offshore oil and gas lease sale proposed for Bristol Bay. Then he'll host a hearing in Anchorage on the department's leasing plans for the next 5 years. Today, he told a news conference in Washington that local opinion is important for all sorts of future development plans for federal waters off the nation's shores, called the OCS or Outer Continental Shelf.
That we hear the communities and the people who are going to be most affected by the decisions that we'll make on the Outer Continental Shelf. The 1.75 billion acres of the OCS are owned by the American citizen. And the development of any kind, whether it be in the renewable energy world or in conventional resources such as oil and gas, should definitely have the input and views of the affected local communities.
Alaska has two-thirds of the nation's coastline. Salazar also announced how the Interior Department intends to spend part of its $3 billion share of the federal economic stimulus money. $15.2 million of it will go into volcano monitoring. He said the department will closely track how the $3 billion are spent to make sure it meets the goal of creating jobs.
Under the very rough formulas that have been developed here, we expect that we will be able to create, with the investment that is being made through interior agencies, somewhere in the neighborhood of 100,000 jobs. And that's with all of the $3 billion that comes through interior, then about half a billion that will go through the Department of Transportation for roads in our parks facilities.
Secretary Salazar said $140 million will be available for some 300 U.S. Geological Survey projects across the country from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. Of the $15.2 million dedicated for improved volcano monitoring nationwide, Alaska receives the largest sum of just over $7 million. Secretary Salazar specifically noted Alaska and the opportunity to improve preparedness and vigilance for all 33 of the volcanoes the AVO monitors. Mount Redoubt is still erupting, but the aviation code has been reduced to orange. The National Weather Service reports a continuous plume is rising from the volcano, but NWS reports no ash emission at this time. With Mount Redoubt's activity over the last few weeks, the disruption of flights has made the job of supplying Western Alaska stores even tougher than usual. KNOM's John Francis in Nome has more.
Stores in Bush, Alaska have a lot to contend with when it comes to getting perishable goods and items to customers. Between bypassed mail, weather, and even the occasional volcano, the challenges have to be met by Nome's three store managers daily. Nome Trading Company manager Bill Cash admits that while a supply chain is vulnerable, they can't just raise prices overnight to compensate.
Whenever there is a fog out or a snow out or Mount Redoubt blows up, it throws everything behind it. particularly in perishables, produce, milk, eggs, things like that. Every 6 months you take an inventory and see how you're doing, and then you decide a new strategy. Just because something happened like Redoubt, you just don't go ahead and raise prices right now. You just do the best you can, take care of the customer with what you have, because basically you can't invent an apple or an orange or a head of lettuce or a gallon of milk.
But even when the weather is calm, the stores have another set of problems stemming from cargo delivery, according to Alaska Commercial Company Manager Mike McNally.
Bypass mail system can be quite unpredictable. It's not a perfect system, but it is the most cost-effective system for getting merchandise up here. Again, it comes down to a carrier's what they call lift, if they have enough lift or capacity. And a carrier never knows from day to day how much bypass mail is going to be put upon them from the post office. So they may be overwhelmed and it may not all go today or the next day. And there's really no way to track it. It's not like a FedEx shipment. You just don't know until it shows up at the back door.
Store managers like McNally also have to deal with unforgiving suppliers.
Essentially, when you order merchandise from your suppliers, you've paid for it. As soon as it goes out their door, you own it. So if it gets damaged, lost, or spoiled, or what have you, it just cuts into your business. There's no real recourse for that. There are some of our products that we bring up here that are not bypass, that are a little bit more sensitive. For example, ice cream that will air freight. But again, if the planes can't fly, it doesn't matter whether it's air freight or bypass.
But Nome Safeway manager Pam Parnell says her store does have a way to combat those expiration dates.
Safeway has a warehouse in Anchorage called JBG, and I've been working closely with them. So we're trying to get them to take our dairy load that came from the Seattle area and distribute that to other stores in Anchorage so we can get the freshest product possible. Because if we're not going to get it anyway, why let the older dated stuff even come in? Because people are going to want to buy the most fresh dated anyway.
Parnell agrees with Cash and McNally that the complaints about getting products into the bush come from one source.
People that have lived here for a number of years are pretty understanding when they see the empty shelves. And it's usually the newer people that go, you know, how come you guys don't order this? And say, it's been ordered for weeks, but it's just not here. And so I think in general, most people are pretty understanding. We all face unique challenges living in Nome or the bush communities.
No matter which issue managers contend with, McNally says it all comes down to rural Alaska's modern-day transportation lifeline.
In the lower 48, when you buy groceries from a supplier, there's a scheduled delivery day and time. In Nome, it doesn't work that way. It shows up whenever the planes have either the capacity or don't have any other weather issues, or like we have right now in Volcano. Kind of makes me imagine what it was like back during the gold rush before groceries were actually flown to the bush. Most of your groceries would come in the summertime, so perishables were almost non-existent. And that's kind of like the situation we're dealing with right now with that volcano. Because if the planes don't fly, nothing comes in.
In Nome, I'm John Francis.
Two environmental groups are suing the state over predator control. The action filed by Defenders of Wildlife and the Alaska Wildlife Alliance alleges the state is not managing all animals for sustained yield as required by the state constitution. The group's attorney, Mike Frank of Trustees for Alaska, says state efforts to reduce wolf and bear numbers to pump up moose and caribou populations do not follow the sustained yield mandate.
The state contends that the sustained yield clause does not apply to predators, including wolves and bears, and we contend that it does.
Board of Game Chairman Cliff Judkins contends the principle is being adhered to for both predator and prey species, but in different ways. He says the state's control programs are aimed at reducing predator numbers to low levels without wiping the species out.
We take care of sustained yield for wolves by stating a minimum numbers that have to be left there, and that the commissioner will close the wolf take when we get close to that number. So we're providing a protection with the number that the biologists tell us is the number we need to maintain sustainable wolf population.
Judkins says he's confident that department biologists have provided good numbers to ensure that predator populations will survive while allowing moose and caribou numbers to grow.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Earlier this week, the North Pacific Fishery Management Council instituted a hard cap on Chinook salmon bycatch within the pollock industry. Each individual boat is allocated a number of salmon based on their pollock quota. If they catch more than that number of salmon, they have to stop fishing. Although the total bycatch number is set at 60,000, the new rule aims to keep the average bycatch at 47,591,000 or fewer through the use of industry-developed incentive plans. Alan Haney, an economist at the Alaska Fisheries Science Center in Seattle, analyzed the two proposed plans.
I'm optimistic that a well-designed incentive system coupled with a hard cap is really going to let us best address this problem.
Haney says that the plans force the fleet to take individual responsibility for their bycatch. The council has approved two basic incentive plans. The first is called the FIP, the Financial Incentive Plan, and focuses on the offshore sector. In the plan, each vessel puts money into a pool at the beginning of the season, $22.05 per ton, which adds up to millions of dollars per company.
The ante, the pool of money that was put out, will be returned to the people, to the companies and the vessels that anteed into this pool in relation to how few salmon they caught. So there's a per salmon incentive through this mechanism that increases the smaller the number of salmon there are bycaught.
The boat with the lowest bycatch gets the most money. Haney says this program makes it beneficial to protect salmon, even in years of low abundance, when their survival is the most important. The plan has received criticism, however, because competition can stop communication.
I don't think this is a very large problem, because the best way to communicate information about bycatch rates is through the observer program.
The new regulation will require increased observer coverage of the pollock fleet, as well as more real-time bycatch reporting through the electronic e-landings program. While the FIP is more geared toward the offshore fleet, the SSIP, or the Salmon Savings Plan, is aimed at the onshore sector.
Each vessel, when it is below the 47,000, their share of the 47,000 level hard cap, they acquire savings that they can use in subsequent years over the next 3 years to potentially go above their share of 47 up to the upper limit.
That means over 3 years, the boats could build up enough insurance to protect themselves if they get a lightning strike or a chance encounter with a large number of salmon. The first year of the program allows boats to go above their caps, but they have to pay back those fish over the next 2 years. The problem with this plan is that it has fewer incentives to avoid bycatch during low abundance years. Fairbanks area residents will have the option to recycle their trash. Local businessman Bernie Carl is expanding an industrial recycling operation to take household garbage from the public. He says he's opening a warehouse at his K&K recycling business in North Pole later this year to accept trash.
Putting in a 60 by 100 recycling center, by the end of the year, we will be recycling glass, paper, cardboard, plastics, electronics. One-stop shop to recycle everything. You'll be able to drive right inside, honk your horn. The door will open up. You come in, and you sort of separate yourself.
Carl says he'll make use of everything that's dropped off. He says some items will be baled and shipped to lower 48 markets, but most will be recycled on site.
All the glass will be ground for pathways, roads, and for hydroponic growing. All the plastics will be baled and we hope to put an injection molding plant in here. Everything has a purpose and has a use.
Carl says all cardboard, paper, and wood waste will be used to fuel a biomass generator at the facility. Carl has an agreement with Golden Valley Electric to sell power to utility for less than avoided cost, a local first for an alternative energy project. The biomass generator is being developed in partnership with United Technologies, the same company that built the world's first low-temperature geothermal generator at Carl's Chena Hot Springs Resort. The biomass power plant, which can also burn locally cultivated willows, has state and federal backing to demonstrate a unit that could work in rural Alaska. Carl says the generator is the centerpiece of a sustainable system that incorporates hydroponic greenhouses fed by exhaust from power generation.
I believe that every village in Alaska can be self-sufficient in 10 years if they so desire, for all their energy needs, for all their food, for all their fuel in 10 years, if they want to be.
Carl says the biomass facility will be the world's first power plant to run without a smokestack. He says CO2 will be pumped into greenhouses to grow vegetables, while other emissions will be filtered out and recycled through bioremediation and other on-site processes. The Yukon Quest goes primetime on German TV this weekend. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, a two-part public television documentary is scheduled to broadcast to a large audience.
The Yukon Quest program airs over the Easter holiday, Sunday and Monday evenings on ARD, the largest national TV network in Germany. ARD producer Dagmar Havestad in Los Angeles says the documentary will show in a high-profile spot with large viewership.
The Easter weekend, and people are, you know, in their families and they're at home and they have a holiday. So you have an adult audience anywhere between 5 to 8 million.
Havestad says Germans have a big appetite for the wilderness and adventure of the Yukon Quest.
Germany is a pretty highly densely populated area. There's hardly any big wilderness out there, so the Germans yearn for the open spaces, and they have a particular fondness of Northern America and the Yukon and Alaska and that last wild adventure that you can live there. So they are particularly drawn to a story like that.
Havestad says awareness of sled dog racing has increased in Germany since Governor Sarah Palin's run for the vice presidency last fall.
Funnily aware more of those races because the husband of the Republican candidate for vice president is known to run races. I don't think people in Germany understand he's not doing dog sled races, but, you know, iron dogs. But somehow that has put sled dog or racing with sleds and sled dogs on the public radar.
Havestad says the Yukon Quest garnered extra attention this winter because German emigre Sebastian Schnulle won the race. The ARD Quest documentary features footage shot along the trail during the 2009 race and primarily focuses on the stories of frontrunners Hugh Neff and William Cleeden, another German.
Es ist das härteste Hundeschlittenrennen der Welt.
Den Schlitten unbeschadet darüber.
Havestad says the program documents the Yukon Quest experience as it happened without any of the staged elements of reality TV shows. Quest Alaska director Tanya Simpson says the high-profile documentary represents an opportunity to grow support for the race.
We're really, you know, pleased and excited as an organization to see the coverage that took place and certainly the publicity and the exposure that can be generated from this in the European market.
It's unclear if the German Quest documentary will show in North America, but Havestad says it's possible a subtitled version will be entered into U.S. film festivals. The Yukon Quest saw unprecedented attention from video producers this year. Two other documentaries filmed along the race trail are in the works, including productions by a Canadian TV station and one by University of Alaska Fairbanks journalism students. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, John Francis in Nome, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, and Rosemary Alexander in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. And by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.